You know what would be really nice right about now on a Friday? 5, maybe 6 minutes of really good analysis of what the heck happened in this economic week. That's what. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 21st of June. Good to have you along, everybody. It is written right here in the bylaws of business and economic journalism that I have to say this, so here goes. The geopolitical news might be getting most of the headlines this week, but one ignores economic reality at one's peril, so we are here for that, also for the week gone by. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. John Harwood is with CNBC. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Anna, let me start with you, and let's start with trade and something that actually I think did get lost in the shuffle. Well, the president tweeted it out, so one never knows. A win for the president. The Mexican Senate approved the USMCA, a big-ish deal even after all the tariff back and forth that the White House has been doing with the Mexicans the last, you know, month or so.
That's right. So it's kind of ironic. It was Trump's idea to rework this agreement, but it passed in Mexico first, and the U.S. could actually be the hardest place for it to pass right now. So there is a holdup in Congress right now about whether or not they can pass the agreement. The Democrats are saying that the labor, environmental, and pharmaceutical provisions aren't good enough, and Republicans are basically accusing them of playing politics and holding up this big achievement for the president. The question is, you know, whether the Trump administration and President Trump has the political savvy going forward to work with the Democrats and give them what they need to pass it. They are in control in the House right now, and the president hasn't always been the smoothest when it comes to cooperating with Nancy Pelosi. So we'll see. We'll see what happens here in the next few months.
Yeah, fair statement right there, John. Let me continue with you and trade a different slice of it. The president goes to the G20 in 10 days or so. We are told there will be a sit down with President Xi. They will certainly talk trade. Do you expect any actual movement to happen?
I expect that President Trump, at the end of the day, when it gets up to the point where China is going to retaliate, the president potentially may expand those 25% tariffs to another $300 billion worth of Chinese goods, is going to pull back from conflict. China needs a deal. The president needs a deal. We have an economy that is slowing. The American business community does not want an extended trade conflict, nor do financial markets. The president pays attention to those. I think it's going to be tricky to see how they can navigate a face-saving resolution. I expect that we will get one, though.
But Anna, the USTR, the U.S. Trade Representative, has been holding hearings this week about that next tranche of tariffs the president is talking about. They are certainly gearing up for more, yeah?
Yeah. So while the president is considering this, USTR is going ahead and laying the groundwork for him to really up the ante with tariffs on the rest of goods from China that we have not put taxes on so far. So, you know, I think the stakes are really high and we'll have to see what happens. You know, predicting the course the Trump administration is always such a safe activity, right? Yeah. But it does seem like the president and his advisors are more and more aware that a bad meeting, a bad outcome here clearly has the potential to tank the markets, that it could be really bad for the economy. The IMF said recently that if the president were to follow through on this $300 billion tranche of tariffs, in addition to those already put in place, that could subtract half a percentage point from global GDP. So that's not negligible. And the president is also under pressure politically to stay tough on China. So that's a calculation that he will have to make. But certainly when it comes to the markets and the economy, they are pushing him towards some kind of resolution.
John Harwood, a detour here to one Jay Powell on the Federal Reserve. The Fed met this week on interest rates, as we all know, decided not to do anything, but did come out and say, in essence, look, we're gonna cut reasonably soon-ish, which comes at an interesting time because the president is, as is his wont, squeezing Chair Powell pretty hard. There is political peril here, but also economic peril.
There's no question. And Jay Powell said in to the conversation that you and I and Anna have just been having, he said that the weak points of the economy right now are manufacturing, investment, and trade. Services are doing fairly well. The consumer's fairly strong at the moment. But that's a real concern for the economy as we look toward growth receding under 2% in the latter part of this year. Chairman Powell did signal that he's going to do that. On the other hand, he was put in a very awkward place by the president with the pressure. Even the day before the meeting, the president saying, well, let's see what he does as I decide whether or not I'm going to try to demote him from the chairmanship. But I do think that there is a legitimate case to be made that the Fed moved too aggressively to raise rates. You have economists on the left as well as the right saying rates should come down a bit, and I expect that will happen if in July, or if not, then in September.
Anna, do you think, I'm going to take a turn here with John in a minute to the debates that are happening this week, this coming week, the Democratic debates. But do you think, covering trade as you do, that there is an appetite for trade to become a political issue in the 2020 campaign?
That's interesting. I mean, I think that there are other issues that are more important to Americans. You know, we consistently hear about health care. But, you know, trade obviously was something that resonated in 2016.
Yeah.
And we have heard, you know, Democrats try to broach this topic. I think that the president has put them in a little bit of an awkward position because in some respects, he's actually taken on some positions that Democrats had supported. Like, you know, Chuck Schumer had called for a long time for a tariff against China, you know, Democrats generally more in favor of a trade policy that would, you know, protect American workers, support unions, things like that. So, you know, they've had to kind of walk a narrow line and say, you know, we support the tough stance on China, but we don't support hitting our trade partners. And, you know, I think he's just kind of put them a bit on their back foot when it comes to talking about trade.
So, John, about the debates and briefly, by which I mean like less than 45-ish seconds, it's going to be pandemonium, right? Two nights, 10 candidates per night. What breaks through in the economy, do you think, on, what is it, Wednesday and Thursday?
Well, I think the big issue was teed up by former Vice President Biden in his remarks at a fundraiser this week when he was speaking to some high-dollar donors, and he raised the idea of economic change that makes the economy more fair, that doesn't produce fundamental alteration in our institutions. That on the one side, on the right of the Democratic debate, and then you've got Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren pushing on the left side and saying, no, we need structural reform, we need corporate governance reform, major tax legislation. That's the fault line in this debate. Moderate incremental change and a calmer political environment, or dramatic change to address wealth and income inequality.
John Harwood at CNBC, Anna Swanson at The New York Times, thanks you two for your insights.
You bet.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street this Friday, finished within spitting distance of flat, the major indices did. Good week overall, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here with something of a corporate conundrum prompted by this item. L'Oreal Paris, that is the Paris brand of the much larger overall L'Oreal parent company, now has a female president for the first time. The conundrum is that you'd think the beauty industry would be one part of the economy where women would soon be running out of those kinds of firsts. In reality, no. Beauty does have better representation of women in leadership roles than other industries, but men still dominate the C-suite and the boardroom, at least at the biggest companies, as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports.
A full face day for your typical woman might involve a sunscreen, maybe two tinted moisturizers or foundations she blends together, an eyeshadow, an eyeliner, bronzer, blush, lip gloss, mascara. I could go on. Whether there's a woman at the helm of the companies that make those products often depends on the size of the brand. Iris Kuo is the CEO of Ledbetter, which compiles data on women in leadership at major consumer companies.
Personal care performed the highest in terms of board representation at 34% female.
That's actually better than any other industry.
And then they were among the top performers on executive team representation at 24% female.
Still, for an industry that sells primarily to women, Kuo says those numbers aren't all that great. Linda Bolton-Weiser covers the beauty industry for D.A. Davidson. She says when it comes to smaller private companies like Glossier, Josie Moran, Thrive Cosmetics,
you'd be amazed at how prevalent it is for women to be CEOs and founders of these beauty companies. It's very common, more so than in other industries.
Female founders can be a draw for consumers, says Lauren Goodsit, a beauty analyst at Mintel.
That's almost a piece of the marketing technique, is to really talk through the brand founder, why they created this brand. It makes the brands a bit more personal and gives the consumers that extra benefit.
A benefit Goodsit thinks has caught the attention and interest of bigger brands. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
As the Supreme Court winds down its term at the end of this month, we are going to look back to a year ago today when the court overturned a ban on states collecting sales tax from most online commerce. Marketplace's Erica Barris checks in on how state treasuries have fared since.
For years, states couldn't collect sales taxes from online merchants unless those companies had a physical presence in the state. So states were missing out on revenue from online shoppers, an estimated $10 to $20 billion a year, says Carl Davis with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy.
So this is money that's used to fund schools and roads and police and healthcare and everything else. It meant there were fewer dollars flowing in for all these core services.
States saw a 5.4% increase in sales tax revenues between the time the decision was handed down to this past April, according to the Urban Institute. But it's hard to know exactly how much of that is due to the new rules. Some states started collecting taxes later than others, and other states still don't have the technology sorted out, says Jared Walczak with the Tax Foundation.
Some of the other states are playing catch up and are still trying to put these systems together for their administrative purposes so they can collect the taxes, but also for the retailers who need a way to integrate this with their sales systems.
It still isn't easy for smaller retailers to collect the right sales tax for every jurisdiction. Richard Pomp, a law professor at the University of Connecticut, says states are trying to overcome that problem with laws that require e-commerce platforms to collect the taxes.
What this means is that an Amazon, which for a long time has collected on all of its own sales, will now be collecting on sales made by third parties.
And for shoppers looking to avoid sales taxes, Pomp says at this point, there just isn't any way around them. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The good people at the World Bank tell us that the dollar amount of payments sent home to low and middle income countries by overseas workers, remittances is the technical term, it hit a record high in 2018, $529 billion, a nearly 10% bump over a year earlier. And those payments really matter. Remittances account for 20% of El Salvador's entire economy, for just one example. So it's a strong and it's a growing market, which means more companies want in, technology companies among them. Facebook is hoping its new cryptocurrency, Libra, you might have heard of that one this week. They're hoping that'll be in the mix. But Facebook is not the only tech company out there, you know. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
About half an hour northeast of downtown Los Angeles, Aurora Mundia sits at her dining room table with her iPad. But she's not playing a game or streaming Netflix. She's taking care of some business.
Yeah, I sent money to my sister in the Philippines.
Mundia is in her mid-60s, works as a cook at an assisted living home. She's been sending money to her family in the Philippines for almost 30 years. She doesn't make a ton of money, but her sister's unemployed back home.
I sent $100. Sometimes, if I have extra money, I send $200. Yeah. Sometimes she calls me, oh, do you have extra money? Yeah, can you send me some? And then I'll send it right away.
Other members of her family who live in the U.S. and in Japan also help their relatives in the Philippines. Mundia used to send her money through an old standby, Western Union. Then somebody told her about an app called Zoom that she finds cheaper and more convenient. That's Zoom with an X, now owned by PayPal.
So I'm going to go log in. So I have to put my password in here. They told me to select country, so I'm going to select Philippines now.
She types in the amount she wants to send, $50 this time. The app converts those dollars into Filipino pesos as she types.
It's 2,500 pesos.
Zoom will send the money and tack on a fee, $5 this time. Startups promising to disrupt the remittance market are popping up all over the place. Grisha Rather manages the U.S. side of operations for a company called American Cash Exchange. It has offices here and in Mexico. It's been in the remittance market for 17 years.
Every week, there's probably one or two new e-wallet companies trying to enter the Mexican market that also have participation in the U.S. that somehow want to make that transfer of funds easier.
Mexican nationals sent more than $33 billion home last year, and 94% of those dollars were from the U.S. A London company called World Remit just raised $175 million in venture capital. It's promising fast transfers and fee transparency. Jason Alou follows financial technology at Piper Jaffray. He says even though the remittance market is growing increasingly crowded and the competition is forcing fees down, the older, lower tech and more expensive MoneyGram and Western Union still have an advantage.
It works and people rely on it and it's worked for them, so they don't necessarily see the need to change to a digital solution.
Maria Alvarado certainly doesn't. I met her outside a Western Union in downtown Los Angeles. She does send money to her family back home in Mexico, but you won't find her doing it on an iPad.
I've never tried to send money over the internet because I don't know how to use a computer.
She says Western Union just feels safer. She trusts it. Facebook wants people like Alvarado to trust it in the remittance market. It's got one big carrot to offer. It says people will be able to use its planned cryptocurrency payment system for next to nothing. Back in Northeast Los Angeles, I ask Aurora Mundia if she'd be swayed by a lower fee.
Well, I don't know. If it's free, yeah, but...
But for the time being, she says she's fine with paying the $4.99 to get the money to her sister, just as long as it gets there. In Los Angeles, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We have one guy, do you have a kayak? No, but we have what's called the search bar.
Shopping just ain't what it used to be, is it? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials finished the session down a 10th percent, 34 points, 26,719. S&P 500 also down a 10th, that is 3 points, close to 2,950. The NASDAQ down 2/10 percent, 19 points. 8,031. But as I said, for the week, not so bad. The Dow added 2.4%. The S&P 500 up 2.2%. The NASDAQ gained 3%. Rough sailing for Carnival Cruise Lines this week. The company cut its profit forecast for the year. Finished the day down 4.4%. That's on top of the 7.6% it lost yesterday. Ouch. And in the wake of that, a couple of its competitors took hits as well. Norwegian Cruise Lines down 2.7%. Royal Caribbean down 3.2% today. Bonds down as well. That's the price. The yield goes the other way. 10-year T-note rose to 2.05%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace turned 30 this year, and to celebrate, we are going back to the 1980s. Check out our new thank you gifts that you can choose from when you become a Marketplace investor. Your donation, big or small, will help us keep bringing you news and information you trust for years to come. So please donate today at marketplace.org. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Turns out there may be a whole bunch not to like about the like buttons of the social media world. Mental health professionals and child advocates say the drive that a lot of kids have for validation and popularity on Instagram and the rest of them can lead to anxiety and depression, low self-esteem as well. Instagram itself, which public service announcement here is owned by Facebook, gave a nod to that not too long ago when it said it was going to experiment with hiding those like counts on some posts. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman dug a little bit deeper on the like problem.
The like button is an integral feature of Instagram, allowing a user to give a click of approval to a picture or video that someone has posted. Counting likes can turn into a popularity contest, and for kids, that can be a problem, says Dimitri Christakis, editor-in-chief of JAMA Pediatrics.
Children compare themselves to others via social media, and that can lead to feelings of inadequacy, social isolation and depression and anxiety.
Christakis says more research is needed to prove these connections. And a test of sorts is now being conducted by Instagram itself. For about 8 weeks, some Instagrammers in Canada have only been seeing the number of likes on their own posts. An Instagram spokesperson said the company's CEO is bullish on the results so far, but offered no other details. Pamela Hurst Della Pietra of the group Children and Screens called on Instagram today to ditch like counts altogether.
For United States users, and not just as an experiment.
Amassing likes allows Instagram influencers to attract advertisers. But CFRA analyst John Freeman says he wouldn't be surprised if Instagram does de-emphasize likes going forward because people are gaming the system.
From the advertiser's perspective, they're not interested in the number of likes.
They want richer data.
Not just likes, but strong dislikes. And how many of those dislikes came from Pennsylvania?
Freeman says moving away from likes could also be a way for Instagram and its owner, Facebook, to appease critics who are concerned about how social media affects young people. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There aren't too many American companies more iconic than Sears. There also aren't too many American companies more troubled than Sears. Tumbling sales the past decade, store closings, bankruptcy last fall, a messy restructuring fight. Troubled. Now, though, Sears is working on a new concept, selling its old-school goods using some brand-new tactics. From the Marketplace Hub at KCUR in Kansas City, Peggy Lowe is on that one.
The facelift is obvious the minute you step into a Sears Home and Life store. There's big video screens behind a welcome desk. Two people in blue polo shirts, a man and a woman, greet me and tell me that the store manager is helping a member.
Our members.
Yeah. Your members?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Members.
Like Costco?
Yeah.
Well, more but like better. Members of our family, but yeah, like Costco.
This new concept store opened Memorial Day in Overland Park, Kansas, a suburb of Kansas City. It's one of just three so far. The others are in Lafayette, Louisiana, and Anchorage, Alaska. Store manager Richard Herring says the store is much smaller than the traditional Sears outlets. Gigantic stores averaging about 150,000 square feet and often serving as mall outlets.
This is like 10 to 15,000 square foot, so it's a smaller footprint. But it's more intimate.
Herring shows me around. The store has a large space for mattresses, dishwashers, air conditioners, refrigerators, and stoves. It took a page from IKEA by placing the appliances in a simulated decorated kitchen, fitting them in around cupboards.
So it's another visual. This is what it's going to look like inside your home. And space is like a real good issue for a lot of people, so we have them measure just to make sure it's going to fit.
Sears says the company's new home and life stores offer a tactile experience that online shopping cannot. But what about all the stuff that people expect to see in a Sears store? Herring says that has come up with customers.
They come in here and they go, man, you don't have any tools. You don't have any clothes. You know, we have one guy, do you have a kayak? No, but we have what's called the search bar.
The search bar is a computer near the front of the store where people can order things the store doesn't carry, which will then be delivered to the store for free. Customers must then pick up those purchases. There's also a small selection of other brands. Sears says the store is trying to appeal to baby boomers who are familiar with Sears brands like Kenmore appliances. And since boomers are downsizing, Sears is also hoping to attract what it calls young forming families who are upsizing into homes. I met 41-year-old Matt Campbell at a Kansas City coffee house. He owns a home here. He says he buys appliances at the big box stores like Home Depot or Best Buy, and he hasn't been to a Sears in years.
I know my dad was always, you know, you go to Sears for tools, but that's been a long, long time ago.
More than a decade ago, the chain had about 900 full-line stores that offered appliances, but also apparel, some automotive products, and home and garden equipment. Now, there are more than 200 of those stores left around the country. So will this new concept work for the struggling company? Atul Kulkarni, an assistant professor of marketing at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, says it feels like a last-ditch effort to salvage the brand.
You could say that, you know, maybe, you know, Sears Light in the sense that, you know, it's 10% of what Sears used to be in the past. That's one way to look at it.
Sears executives say they're committed to this concept for the long haul, and they're getting ready to open 4 more home and life stores around the country. In Overland Park, Kansas, I'm Peggy Lowe for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's actually from yesterday, but I saw it and I ignored it in the hope that it would go away, but it didn't. This is, I'm pretty sure, this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us, cross-branding promotion edition. KFC is out with a new sandwich, we are told. It's the KFC Cheetos Chicken Sandwich. Toasted bun, special Cheetos sauce on an extra crispy chicken filet resting on a bed of Cheetos. For those of you who say, but Kai, I put potato chips on a sandwich, it's great. Yeah, me too, but no, this is different.
Hey, it's Molly Wood here, and I want you to listen to the latest Make Me Smart. This week, we're talking about facial recognition technology. Companies like Amazon are using it in ways we don't always know about. Airports are scanning our faces in terminals to speed up the security process. But as our facial data is collected for convenience, what are we giving up? Take that recent data breach at Customs and Border Patrol.
They were collecting these images of license plates and people driving through the border, and it just went out into the world. Can't take that back.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you podcast.
All right, we're going. Dow Industrials down a 10% today, 34 points. S&P 500 also down a 10th. That's about 3 points there. NASDAQ down 0.2%. That is 19 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.